Hello, this is Daniel Horowitz. I'm in Brooklyn, New York, on Zoom with Anita Rivera, and I'm interviewing her as part of the Education Narratives Project at the Oral History Summer School. And will you please introduce yourself?
My name is Anita Rivera. I'm being recorded from Mount Kisco, New York, on Zoom, and I'm being interviewed as part of the Educational Narratives Oral History Project.
My first question is, I'd just like you to describe where you are right now.
I am an ineffective teacher right now in many ways. A lot of what I would normally do has eroded, you know, my normal practice of cooperative learning and discussion-based learning and engaging kids in projects and in seminars. A lot of the active part of teaching has sort of disappeared. And I sit at a desk 6 feet apart or more, 6 feet apart or more from my students. And they're all sitting in rows facing me, generally behind dividers. And there are kids who are still fully remote. So I'm looking at a screen that I can never really leave for long periods of time. And I'm also trying to monitor the kids who are learning from a computer for the most part, because paper-based learning has sort of disappeared in this process. So it's kind of uncomfortable to be a teacher right now in that sense, because you know that it's not the optimal way for kids to learn. But you're kind of tied to this format because of the danger of the pandemic and the exchange of germs that happens, and keeping kids apart is important because if they're together for any serious length of time, they'll end up being quarantined. And then that disrupts their learning even more. So we do have a lot more students back in school, which is great. But in all of my classes, at any given time, I have, you know, 5 to 6 students out of that group, which could be, you know, anywhere from a third to a fourth of my kids who are home. And I don't have access to them. I don't know what they're doing unless I see it on a Google Doc. And a lot of times they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing because nothing happens. When I look at the Google Doc, it's the same way it was the day before. And I say things and I write something in the chat to them to kind of, you know, push them in the right direction. But it's not the same as having the kids in front of me and having them learn from each other and having good discussions. And really that interaction, that human interaction, is kind of missing from both teaching and learning. So it's tough. Continues to be a struggle.
Thank you for sharing that, for diving right in. I want to go a little bit back to how the school year started, because last time you were interviewed, I know it was before then.
So last year in March, we went full remote and we didn't see our students at all in the flesh. Everything was, if we did contact them, it was through messages that we sent. And it was not mandatory for us to have meetings with the kids virtually. That was optional. And there were many teachers who chose not to do it. I decided that at least once a week, I was going to meet with all of my students. The third quarter, when the grades still counted, I would see them. But the fourth quarter, the school decided not to count the grades. And their students who just disappeared off the face of the earth. And once the fourth quarter started, I never saw them again. And they didn't do any of the work either because it didn't count. So September started off very differently. There are accountability measures put into place. And we started with a hybrid learning plan. And there were students who were in class on half the week. So there were students who would come in on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And then a second group of students whose last names began M through Z. They would come in the end of the week and then it would switch. So the A through L students would come in Monday, Tuesday, and then the M to Z kids would get the Wednesday, Thursday, Friday spot. So I had one group coming in one half of the week, another group coming in the other half of the week. But there were a lot of kids who were full remote, who weren't coming in at all. Definitely more kids before they decided to, be more inclusive and allow kids to come back to school. And so the biggest challenge, I think, at first was that I didn't have a lot of things. We had used Google Classroom before to assign work. We were already doing that before the pandemic started. So many of us at my school were familiar with the platform, but I was not using it the way I use it now, like for everything. I would post things on there and I would post instructions on there, but a lot of the stuff that I was doing was hands-on in the classroom. And there would be things that we would do in the classroom that you would never see in the Google Classroom at all. But now everything had to be in there and we have to have daily meets. So that sense of, every period there's a Google Meet and you're trying to somehow interact with another person. You're basically in a meeting all day, like video conferencing all day. So that piece was new. And then the periods were a lot shorter. They're about 35 minutes long. So normally we had a block schedule. So our periods would be about 55 minutes long. And so we would have this kind of lengthy time with kids, which many of us thought was too long. We would rather have like the 40, 45 minute period. But 35 minutes is just a little bit too short to like do certain things and get certain things done. And the kids who arrive a few minutes late, the kids who leave a few minutes early in the video conferencing, that kind of chips away at things. And so you're looking at, you're spending a half an hour with most of your class in front of you trying to teach something and not knowing for the most part whether or not kids are really engaged, because there's really no way to tell. Because there are kids who will keep the camera on and they'll be on screen the whole time. Their faces are there and you can see them, but you don't know what they're doing on their computer. They could be watching a video on Netflix. You have no way of knowing if that's what they're doing. They could be playing video games, but at least they'll show you their whole face. And then there are the kids who show you like from the eyebrows up, like you sort of see not even their eyes, but just sort of like the brow and like the forehead and like a little bit of hair. And then there are the kids who like, you just see like a tuft of hair, like a little tiny bit of tuft of hair. And then you see like ceiling view. Like this is mostly what I see from the remote kids in my classroom. It's like a view of their ceilings. And every day I have to remind kids, you need to have your cameras on. I need to actually see your face so I can actually see that you're in the class and we can have some type of connection with each other, because you're all the way on the other side of wherever. And there's no connection if I can't even see your face. I can't see your eyes. I can't see your expression. I can't, when you're talking to me, I have no idea, that all those nonverbal cues are missing. So that definitely from the beginning was kind of a conflict, that was created with certain students where they really had a hard time being on camera all day long. And some of the kids chose to break their computers. Not literally, like they would just say, my camera's broken. And they have been off screen all year since the camera was broken. You would think that would be fixed and, addressed, but for the most part, that's probably not the case, because you figure it out other ways that that's not the case and that what they're saying is not true. But it's more that they're not used to, they're uncomfortable with this format of somebody looking at them. There's something off-putting about that. And even though nobody's looking at them, the fact that they know that somebody could be looking at them, it really just, throws them for a loop. They really have a hard time with it. And for the most part, kids try to avoid eye contact. They try to avoid being seen on camera. If they could get away with it and have their screens off during the whole class, that's how the kids would roll. Like that's just, what they would prefer. So I think one of the things that was tough was like the planning time, trying to get everything in a digital format and making sure that it worked in a digital format. But also what I ended up finding is that I had to cut a lot of content out. Like there were just some things that I just couldn't do anymore. So like my freshman class, we would normally read, like have 8 separate reading units over the course of the year. So it'd be 5 class novels that we would read together and study together. And then there'd be 3 independent reads that I'd worked into my curriculum, which is really a nice high volume of reading for high school kids. And then, of course, they could read on their own whatever they wanted to read, but that's what I was holding them accountable for. And I couldn't do it this year because of kids in two separate locations and then not having access to the materials that I had in the room for the literature circles that I was trying to set up, and then maybe asking kids at home, can you get a copy of Hey Kiddo, or you know, or a copy of the graphic novel Speak, because one of the units that I do is a graphic novel unit. It just seemed like a something that was really difficult to ask of kids. And I just kind of stepped back from that. I was like, I don't have the time with these half an hour classes. I really just need to focus on making sure that I'm consistent with whatever it is I'm delivering. I have routines in place and this extra stuff that would normally make the class more interesting had to go away. Ironically enough, I used to do an oral history narrative project with my kids where they would interview a family member about coming of age. And it's one of the more successful things that I've done as a teacher. And because of the pandemic, I couldn't do it last year and I couldn't do it this year. So there's like 2 years of kids who have not experienced this project at all. And part of that is just not having enough time and then not being able to hold the kids accountable and see their notes and have them, you know, have that kind of exchange with them and, you know, really talk to them about how to go about doing this. Like, so many of those interchanges about teaching, like with teaching and kids, like it happens over the course of time in the classroom where you walk over to a kid and you're seeing something that they're doing, even if it's on camera. Like, you know, you look at your, you can look at their Google Doc, but then you can get up and you can go over and have a quiet conversation with the kid on the side. Now, like, it's on blast. Like, if I talk to a kid at home, everybody hears the conversation. Like, there's no privacy, there's no sense of intimacy, there's no like coaching in the corner. It's all like out there. And so that also kind of inhibits what I say. And it prevents me from providing constructive criticism at times because I don't want to hurt the kids' feelings. You know, so I end up like typing this long thing to kids like on their Google Doc to try to present it that way. I'll try to say things in a very kind of political manner and gentle manner. But I find that a lot of times I avoid pushing kids and critiquing kids because it's so decontextualized. They can't really see my face. They can't necessarily hear my intent. And I feel like something's going to get lost. And I feel that's a part that I've been struggling with definitely is the inability to do some of the aspects of teaching that are important, like actually seeing something that a kid is doing and taking it to the next level. Unless I type it on the doc, that's another way. And kids pay attention, but there's definitely kids who are getting lost.
You mentioned a lot of changes or a lot of like differences this year because of the pandemic. I'm curious about the decision-making process in those changes and your involvement in it. Or
they had big committees that they formed over the summer. They were re-entry committees and there were teachers on those re-entry committees at all grade levels. But ultimately the decisions that were made for the most part were made by administration with some teacher input, but I don't think that a lot of the decisions that they made were terrible decisions in light of the information that we had. I think they worked with what they had. And so I don't critique those decisions. I think some of the stuff that's happening now though, it troubles me. So like the plastic barrier thing. The kids have to carry around this heavy plexiglass plastic barrier. It's heavy. And when that thing falls, it's like ka-chung, like the whole classroom like looks up and they're like, whoa, because it falls off the desk and it's like this big clatter. And because they're not stable, they're not attached to the desk. And they also have like this sort of cutout that makes them less stable on the bottom of them. It's like a almost like a file folder cutout situation. And so the bottom part is actually a little shorter than the top that goes around them. And so it's easy for them to just fall and collapse off of the desk. So my thing is like, did anybody think to actually test out some of these models before they made the purchase? What is practical for a high school and for kids? Like, I feel like more time should have been spent in choosing something that would actually work in our classrooms and if we were gonna have these plastic barriers at all. What I'm finding is that kids have obliged with the masking and they're really respectful about that and they're all on board. Really, I don't see a lot of kids messing around with that. There's really very few kids who kind of pull it down and have their noses out. But the barriers, there I see rebellion. I see the ways like that they're like kind of, you know, being left in different places of the building, you know, kids walking in without them and then having to go back and get them because they forgot. You know, if they really don't have to have them around their desk if they're 6 feet apart or more in the classroom. That is the standard. And so there are many kids who are like, if they're looking around them and if they're 6 feet apart away from somebody, most of them are just taking the barriers down. Like they're just not, because it's just so inconvenient and they can't see through them either. That's the other piece. It's just like the first ones that they had, which are these kind of flimsy plastic light ones. The kind of plastic that it was almost like a plastic bag, it was weird and it warped and distorted what they were seeing on the board and they couldn't really even see through it. And then when you're watching something in the front of the room, be it what the teacher is presenting, or today we were watching part of the Crucible, Act One of the Crucible, they're trying to crane around like five different barriers that are in front of them to see what's on the board. So I feel like there's some silly things they don't think about how things actually play out in a classroom and how, and you know, you on some level you can't fault them for that because they're not classroom teachers, but at the same time, like there's just some things that could easily have been addressed if they just thought about it, like, well, how would this actually be in the classroom? What is it gonna be like for kids? And a process to kind of survey us and ask us, well, what is it like? So the other thing is the cleaning of the desks. So we're expected after the kids leave our classroom to get a spray bottle of disinfectant that we have, and it's a hydrogen peroxide based one, so it's not anything that's toxic. But we have to spray it on all the desks where kids have sat after they leave the room. Now we don't have to actually wipe it down. When the kids come in, they wipe it down. But it's like this other thing that in between periods, yeah, sure, the passing time is more, and it's 5 minutes now instead of four. Yeah, like. But it's still time consuming to go around and spray 19 desks. So, you know, just seeing like all of that, and then, you know, the sort of, you know, mental exhaustion of constantly being on camera, the stress of knowing that you're not being a good teacher, all the new added routines that we have, the varying ways we have to take attendance and what we have to do with that. It's just a lot to kind of keep track of. And I think there's like a mental exhaustion that a lot of teachers have right now. Like we just can't wait for the year to be over because we're just tired. But it's not even like a physical tiredness. It's more like mentally tired. I just need a break and not video conference for like a month. And maybe I'll feel good. No. So I don't know if I answered the question. I may have kind of veered and wandered a little bit, but I'm trying to think of what else, the administrative decisions, failures. So one of the decisions that they made, which is something new, is they made the floor grade 58. So you could have a kid who didn't show up at all to your class the whole quarter and didn't do any work, and they would get a 58 in the class. So it's interesting because now I have a kid who's a senior and apparently he's managing somehow, even with all his absences, to pass other classes, somehow some type of, you know, gymnastics going on there. But the kid has been present in my class probably about 60% of the time the whole year. He's got easily 40 plus absences since the beginning of the year, which normally a kid would E out of a class after 12 absences. So it's a problem. You know, he's not present or he's late, because that doesn't take into account all the times he comes in 15, 20 minutes late. And he's had a 58 all three quarters, but that's not even his real average. His real average has been a 14, a 19, 23. Like, it's a ridiculously low number that wouldn't normally happen if he was in school and we were normally teaching the way we, I mean, it just would never happen that way. There would be ways that I could hold him accountable in the classroom, but he was full remote since the beginning of the year and he just came back to school this week. And I got an email today from the counselor, and she said that he was just placed in a support class and that the goal is to get him to pass, to do well the fourth quarter so he could pass for the year. And I was like, well, this has been his pattern. And I said, you know, the only reason why he's even eligible to pass is because of the floor grade. So now you're saying that one quarter where he actually does a little bit of work, like that 85 that he needs to get, which I'm not saying he can't do, he could do it if he actually put in the time and the effort, but is going to, you know, make up for those 58s, which are actually 15, 19, and 23. Like, just because it's one support class, like, where was this before? Like, where was this remedy before? Where was the pressure on the parent, you know, to have this kid come into school because he was avoiding school? It wasn't for health issues. It wasn't for any other reason except that he wanted to be home and he didn't want to be in school. And because he's back in school now, because now it's crunch time and he may not graduate because of the poor decisions he made earlier in the year. And so it's like they're trying to put out a fire now. And now it's going to be on me to make sure that he passes with an 85 so that he can leave high school. Where's the kind of agency on his part? Where's the responsibility? This kid is an adult. He's already 20. He's not a young kid. Those kinds of things are administrative decisions. Like they don't want kids failing. So they'll push it back down the pipe and be like, come up with a solution to get this kid out. And you have to make it work. So.
Well, thank you for sharing that story. I'm interested to hear more stories about your students and what you think it's been like for them.
So some kids have done really well. It's funny, I do feel like I am close to some of my kids in spite of this weird setup. I've become close to some of them. They talk to me all the time and they're very comfortable with me. And then the other kids that I feel like I don't have any connection to at all, which that is kind of weird because always there'd be some sense, okay, I know you. Now it's like, I know a few of you and sort of acquainted with some of you and some of you I don't know at all. Like I don't have any, like, and I know next year when they see me, they're not even gonna say hi to me. Like it's, and that's strange. So the kids who have done well, they are kids, I think, for whom, whether it's their personality, home environmental factors that are positive and supportive, solid friendships, different activities they may be involved in outside of class. It's really hard to say what it is, but they're happy, they're social, they're moving through with the academics very successfully. Their grades are great. They come in with a smile on their face. They do everything that you ask them to do and they're good. Like, you know, they're gonna make it through this and they're gonna be fine. And then there's like a group of kids in the middle, which are probably about 50% of the kids that you worry about, Well, no, I would say like they're, I'd say half the kids, I worry about them. I worry about the bottom kids, obviously, because they're just utterly failing and not doing anything. But then the kids who are like, who normally would not be that low, but who are suffering from extreme anxiety, that the pandemic has brought out attentional issues like in full force that these kids have that they could compensate for before, but now they can't anymore. And these attentional difficulties are becoming so hard for them to manage that I've had a number of students this year that they've had neuropsych evaluations that they had, and they've had to be medicated. I have several kids. And that doesn't normally happen like that with high school kids. Like it does happen occasionally, but it's enough that it's noticeable. When I think about it, there's like two in one class, there's one in another. You know, there are these, and it's something that they just can't manage, the on-screen interactions, the way that they have, that nothing is tangible. It's like everything that they're learning is intangible. It's easy for them to look at another tab and be distracted. And because it's intangible, and even if there's a deadline, it doesn't matter because it's intangible. There's not a paper you're handing in. There's not something you're writing down on paper. And they miss deadlines. They're late with work. And when they fall behind, they get so overwhelmed that they don't even bother to make up the work when you give them extensions and you accept the late work. And they're kids that would normally be getting, you know, C's and B's and even A's, and they're failing. And it's concerning because it's almost like a, like become pathologized. Like it's become like an ancillary illness of COVID is this group of kids who would normally under typical circumstances with all the failures of public education, all the limitations of it, they would be fine in school. They would be trudging along, doing their thing, and they'd be fine academically. They wouldn't be failing any classes. Now it's like failure has become an option. Failure has become normal. And avoidance is normal. And shutting down is normal. And anxiety is normal. It's just part of our conversation. Oh, the kid has anxiety. The kid has attention deficit disorder. The kid is depressed. We've had so many kids who've been hospitalized, and really, they really have struggled. So, and then I actually teach a special class. It's called AVID, and I work with first-gen students whose parents didn't go to college. Many of them come from immigrant families, and they're the first generation of their family to go to college. And that class, I have a couple of kids that last year, there are three kids that I think of that had really good years last year. In fact, one of them, since her freshman year, has been on high honor roll every single quarter. An amazing student. She did go through a trauma last year. Actually, it wasn't last year, it was the year before. It was December of 2019. She lost her brother in a car accident. And it was really traumatic for the community. I taught the brother, I taught the older sister, teach her. And I get it, like, but even at the end of the pandemic, like after losing her brother, like last spring, she was still in high honor roll. She was doing everything. And it's almost like she just crashed this year and her grades plummeted. And she didn't make honor roll this past quarter for the first time since the beginning of her high school career. And she's full remote. Now, she wasn't in the beginning, but now she is. And even when she was hybrid, she wasn't really attending on a regular basis. She was acting like a full remote kid. And I'm mystified. I'm like, what's up with this kid? Now, part of me knows it's probably delayed grief. It's some other circumstance, but it's so hard to connect with her and find out because she's not in front of me. And I can't really be like, hey, you know, what's going on here with you? So that's the kind of thing that concerns me, because these other kids who are having issues academically, I don't know what kind of students they were before because I didn't have them before, but the AVID kids I've had since they were freshman year, I know the kind of students that they are. And when I see a kid who last year was maintaining a B average and was so fired up and so diligent and was doing so well, you know, have a 75 average, if that, this school year, every single quarter, you know, and then I talk to the kid and the kid is like tearing up and saying how hard the year has been. I'm like, you know, this is, it's rough. But then again, like I think about the three girls in question, and for some reason they're working. I asked one of the kids whose grades got decimated during this time period, junior year of all years. And she said that she's working. And I said, it's because you have to work, like you're supporting, you know, helping out with the family. And she says, no, I'm saving for a car and I want to save for college. And I said to her, I was like, you know, if you have a junior year like this, where like you're barely passing classes, I was like, it's gonna be really tough for you to get into college. So I don't know what college you're saving for, but you really need to not work as many hours. You need to focus on school. And I also, because I've known these kids for a couple of years now, I was like, why aren't you in school? Why are you working? And then you're full remote for school. Like school, like it should, like school is first for you. You're a young person. That's your job. And it's like they're serving two masters. They're trying to like work, anywhere from 20 to 30 hours after they go to school. Where's the homework time? Where's the review time? They're not prioritizing. And yeah, they're making money, but then it's kind of like a short-term gratification. Because the long-term thing is, if you don't have the grades, then you have less options when it comes to the college that you want to attend. So it's been hard to kind of get that message across to some of these kids. And there are two of them. One of them did come back, which is great. And I think she's doing better academically because she's back. But the other two kids have not come back. And remote learning is really not for them. It's just not. One of them one day was, She emailed me. She's like, I'm not going to be on the meet in class because I have to take this other kid to the doctor. And I know the other kid, but she used the kid's name in the email. I guess that kid is full remote too. And she's like, yeah. And nobody is available to take her to the doctor. So I got to take her. And I was like, really? I couldn't believe it. And so of course she came to the class. And what am I going to say to her? I'm going to have like an argument with her about trying to attend class from a doctor's office when she's only 16. Like, what is she doing anyway? Like, so, and then the other kid, she was on her phone, I guess. I didn't realize it. And I said, can you turn on your camera? And so the volume was on the speaker. So everybody in the class could hear it. It's a speaker so that when the kids at home talk, like everybody in the room can hear, it's like magnifies their voice. And so she's like, Ms. Rivera, I can't turn the camera on because I'm walking back from the bakery right now. I'll be home in a few minutes. I'll probably have to turn off, you know, my phone and then join the Google Meet when I get back. And all the kids in the room were like, they're looking like, what? They couldn't believe it. They were just like looking at each other, like shaking their heads, because it was just so strange. Like, because you're a full remote student, like, what is that about? Like, you're supposed, if you're a full remote student, it seems to me that there's a health issue. There's a compelling reason why you're home. And this kid is working after school, and then she's walking to and from the bakery instead of like being on time for class. Like, what's going on? Like, what is that? And so there's some stuff going on with that. I know in September, they're not gonna allow kids to be full remote. Because there's been too much of this. There are only a couple of kids that it really is for health concerns because, you know, I have one student that has chronic asthma. That's a different situation. But if you're not a kid who has like a chronic health issue that, you know, then why are you home at this point? And especially for my older students, you know, many of them have started to get vaccinated, like they have options. And I just feel like it's really hard to teach two groups of kids like this. And I just hope that they come to some decision about this and that if anything, if they do decide to help kids out, let's say you have chronic health issues and the parents might be concerned, that they figure out a homeschool option for those kids. You know, those kids may have to just decide to homeschool and just so be it, or they figure out a teacher who's designated to work with those kids. But to have the regular everyday classroom teacher with this dichotomy is impossible. It's just, you know, either you have to be everybody is on camera or everybody's in the room, because you can't really do both. Another funny story is I live in the community where I teach, and my next door neighbor, they're teachers in the district too, but they teach at the elementary school level, and their son is a freshman and I have him as a student. And he's a really cute kid, but he's really struggled this year. And so that's been an interesting dynamic, because it's like, I really like you guys, like you're great, you're my neighbors, but like your son is not doing his work, you know? And it's been like pulling teeth to get him like to do work. And he's always behind with everything. And like, say I asked him about his essay, we're supposed to be doing an in-class essay and they have to be finished by tomorrow. And I've been looking at his essay document and there's nothing on it. He shared his outline with me finally after a couple of days of working on it. And the outline was supposed to be done outside of class, and the in-class essay is supposed to be timed so that they could practice for the final. And he said, oh, I'm not gonna be in tomorrow. And I'm like, really? So what is your plan for the essay? And he's like, well, can I work on it over the weekend? And I'm like, no, it's supposed to be a timed practice for the final, and you have to finish it within 2 hours of class. And it's, you know, and holding kids accountable for that and trying to keep on track of these things and hold the line is just impossible. And then I'm just looking at him and I'm like laughing to myself. I'm also smiling at him because he's my neighbor. I'm just like, well, okay, like, what am I going to do? Like, no, you cannot write your essay. So I find myself trying to hold them accountable, knowing that they're going to have a really rough year next year because they're going to be dealing with some demonic teachers who don't accept late work and have no flexibility. It's not even part of their life. And they're going to really, like, they're not going to allow any wiggle room next year. I know it. And these kids are going to be running into these teachers and they're not going to know what to do with themselves. And I'm just, you know, so I'm trying to be a little more like, you know, just really trying to get them to see like there's a limit to that, like there's a deadline to things, there's a moment past which like you can't change it anymore. It's got to be done, and it's really hard for them to kind of see that and to be grounded. They think that there's always a do-over. They think that they can always go back to something. They think that, you know, things are infinite. And again, and I think it comes back to that intangibility of learning that's occurred. And because there's nothing physical that they're producing, it's all in the ether and it doesn't seem quite real. And maybe, you know, deadlines are not real then, and nothing is ever really late. I just, you know, it's gonna be really hard to kind of figure that out, I think, next year. But it'll be easier if there are no remote students. That would be what I prefer. So hopefully my wishes come true.
Thank you for sharing those stories about your students. But I'm curious, you talked about how this pandemic time, it's changed certain students. I'm curious how it's changed teachers.
Oh, we are a grim lot. Everybody's kind of grouchy now by the end of the year. Like whatever tendencies we had to be curmudgeons before, I think it's manifested more. I think that, you know, we are trying our best to be humane, and at the same time, we know that we've that there's some irrevocable loss. So I don't know. I mean, you see your colleagues when you do, because a lot of it has been that I haven't really seen a lot of them because I stay in my room as much as possible and I don't go into the department office once I have to. So I'm really interacting much with people. And when I do, you know, we laugh and we talk like we normally do. But I think that we all feel a sense that we're not effective. We all feel like our hands are tied. We're all on some level blaming someone, you know, for our misery. And we don't, I think I could say for the most part that it would be hard put to find a teacher who actually enjoys teaching full-time remote. Like that says, I love this. I think most teachers are, you know, want to be in the classroom, want to be in person. It's different if it's a teacher who, for health reasons, again, like is forced to do that. And of course they'll compromise. And there are teachers who teach remote classes and we're doing that with Blackboard and these other, you know, forums before that for years. But for that to be the only way to deliver instruction, it's depressing. So, you know, like I there were always complaints in the department office, but now like there's a sort of anger to the way that people sort of feel. And there are definitely people who just don't come into the department office at all anymore. Like you don't see them. People run out of there as soon as the day is over. Like they don't want to be in the school building. I would say I'm one of those. Like, why stay? I mean, there's no sense of community after school. You know, there's no clubs, there's no real interaction with people. So I think teachers are pretty stressed out. And, you know, it's been difficult not to just throw up your hands and be like, oh, you know, just give up and kind of sort of be like, well, it is what it is. And let me just give them all A's, whether they're there or not, and just make stuff up and try to actually have a system and hold kids accountable and really teach and really make sure that they're actually getting something out of the class. I think that actually trying to do that staves off the depression, staves off the feeling of hopelessness, staves off the feelings of being ineffective. When you actually try to move past your own sort of intangible identity as a teacher and you really make an attempt to have a conversation with a kid and connect with that kid and help them. It's the only thing I think that kind of resolves those feelings of bitterness and depression about not being the kind of teacher that you wish you could be in this time period. Because those are the moments when you can actually feel that you're doing something that's legit and giving of yourself, which you never really had to make an effort to do before because kids were there in your classroom. So it's so easy to just go over and be like, hey, you know, and can I help you with this? And this is how you do it and show them. Now you have to really make the effort, especially if a kid is remote. Like you have to call their name. You have to make sure that they're listening. You might have to type them a message too. Talk to them over consecutive days, set up a nice little separate Google Meet to talk with them personally and help them. And that takes effort. Because chances are that meeting is happening outside of school hours. It's not happening during the school day. And so you have to be willing to do that. And it's hard. So I think that a lot of teachers will leave the profession, unfortunately, if it's already like, I think, a profession that is struggling to recruit good people in some ways. I mean, I think there are young people out there who want to be teachers, but funny enough, even if somebody came to me and said, I want to be a teacher, I think I would be honest about the challenges. I probably would tell them not to be an English teacher. It's too much grading. But I would say that I think teaching is great. And I think that it's a great profession and it offers a lot of rewards. But I think I would also, there are teachers out there who I know who have actively discouraged young people from pursuing education. And I worry about that because I think that it's necessary. Like if anything, the pandemic should have taught everyone that you can't have, you know, like it's not effective to have these intangible teachers and intangible classrooms, like on this wide scale level, that there's something about that that is just, you know, eating away at the fabric of things in some way. I think there's a reason why like the systems of school and learning exist, because there's actually something about them that are, you know, even if they're experimental in their setup, the ability of people to come together in a communal setting and for it to be focused on the development of a child or the development of a group of children, and not just the academic aspect, but also the social emotional aspect. And you're not gonna get that within the four walls of your room. It's impossible to address, you know, all of those aspects of a kid within that setting. Where's the art, where's the music, where's the sports, where's the, you know, the friendship, the mentoring. And there are kids who are being deprived of that on a long-term basis. So teachers are struggling. I think that though they have the ability to persevere because of all the setbacks that teachers normally experience in their careers. So there is a lot of perseverance, but I could see a lot of older teachers leaving the profession because it's they probably have already, many of them, because of how tough it is to teach under these conditions. We'll see what happens.
Well, thank you. We're at 47 minutes, and I'd love to end with if you talk about the future a little bit, or what you think the future holds.
Future. For me, I have, after this year, I have 6 more years in my 24th year. I think for me, I definitely will appreciate classroom-based learning a lot more. And I think I will seek to exploit what is best about that modality. And I'm going to enjoy it a lot more, and I'm gonna be happy when things return and we, you know, to normal, whatever, yeah, normal. And we get back to business the way that it normally is. So I don't see myself complaining about teaching in the same way again. I think I'm gonna feel profoundly grateful to have all my kids in one place under the same roof and kind of be working with them on a consistent basis and interacting with them every day. I think that this has been a wake up for schools in terms of the gaps that maybe they didn't even realize were there in terms of helping kids and supporting kids. And so I'm hopeful for is that people will make real serious policy changes and understand that you can't always put a dollar sign on what makes education work, that education and, you know, the education of young people requires an investment, a serious financial investment and a serious investment of people. Like it's teachers who work with kids every day. And it's other support personnel like counselors and school psychologists and learning support specialists and special education teachers, and this whole army of people, ESL teachers who are helping kids to get from point A to point B. And that's the real cost of education is people, because their salaries, their benefits. And a lot of times school districts are willing to just cut the fat, what they think is the fat. And then you have a situation like this where kids are falling through the cracks in droves. And you realize that you can't, you know, operate a school under an austerity budget during a pandemic. Like, it's not going to work because there's all these other expenses that you maybe didn't anticipate. But also, where's the safety net for a lot of these children? And so I'm hopeful that things will change for the better, and that people will just see it for what it is, which is that, you know, we don't take care of our kids and make sure that they're learning, that what kind of adults are they going to be? And are they going to be thriving adults in our community? Because they're not leaving our community. It's not as if the young people who live in this community are just going to go somewhere else, you know, to laze around on the couch and drive their parents crazy. They're going to be living right here and not being effective and not really contributing to our community and not really, you know, happy. And, you know, and so we need to be thinking, you know, what kind of adults do we want out there in the world? You know, happy, successful, functioning adults, you know, who feel like they're part of their community. And, you know, are we gonna say, okay, let's just, you know, think about the bottom line all the time and how much money we're spending, instead of making sure that kids, you know, have the support that they need to be able to graduate, and stressing out teachers who are already at their wits' end, making them pass kids, you know, when they haven't even provided the supports for the kid to do well all along. So I'm hopeful, I'm optimistic that my last years of my career are going to be different, because I'm going to be different. I'm going to be a lot more appreciative. But I also hope that everyone in every level is more appreciative, and that we kind of work together as a society, you know, to make sure that our kids are okay after this, because they've been traumatized in so many ways. And, you know, I personally feel lucky that I have two daughters who, you know, they have not really been seriously affected by the lack of interaction with their peers and the lack of stimulation. That I've somehow held it together for them, and that they're okay. But I'm lucky. Like, I really think that I'm just lucky, because there are plenty of parents out there who have worked just as hard as me, and their kids have fallen apart. Because this is a wide scale traumatic event for our society. So we'll see. You know, my avid kids will graduate next year, and hopefully they'll get into the colleges of their dreams, and this will be a distant, terrible memory for them. And they'll actually get to go to prom and go on their senior trip and maybe get to visit a few colleges as things start opening up and do all the things that have been denied to them. And so I'm really excited about that. And I think next year is going to be great. After I have a long summer off, where I don't do any video conferencing whatsoever.
Thank you so much. Is there anything you'd like to say before we end the interview?
No. I think I covered it all. But it was great meeting you.
So nice to meet you. Right before we end the recording, if you don't mind just introducing yourself one more time so we have it perfectly.
So my name is Anita Rivera. I am here in Mount Kisco. I am a high school teacher. I teach English and AVID at a public high school in Westchester County. And I am doing this interview as part of your Oral History Summer School's Educational Narrative Project.
And it's my pleasure. Thank you so much. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
All right, I'm going to stop the recording now.